I've been asked a lot of Ask a Basket questions. Some of them I'll be answering a little bit later, but whatever happened to Abby Thatcher? Well, Abby went back to drinking for quite some time. Bill continued to speak of him as his sponsor, because the word sponsor was a different concept in those days. Finally, he was taken in to a dude ranch in Texas run by two AAers and kept sober, as I understand, the last 2 years of his life. I recently read that Bill was given belladonna in the hospital. Yes, I think he even says that in his story. Yeah, belladonna was a poison. It was a purgative. It's supposed to get rid of the poisons in his body, the toxins. The first time he goes in the hospital under the so-called belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. And the question was, when he had his spiritual experience, have you heard this? I haven't heard that in particular. The belladonna is certainly mentioned in the first time in the hospital, but it isn't mentioned in the third. Do the roots of AA have a farther reach than the Oxford group, groups, and are its principles and practices found in most religions? I think that's what it says. I would say yes. That's an unqualified yes. You know, one of Bill's great spiritual mentors was Father Dowling, a Catholic priest, who had read the Big Book and said, and came to see him, and told him that the precepts of the 12 steps were found in teachings of the Jesuits from years and years before. Well, why should it be that surprising? Confession is part of the whole Catholic approach. Jews are right now, religious Jews are going through Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, or Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, depending on whether you're old school or new school, and I'm old school. And that's a whole time of contrition and atonement and confession and apologies. Where can I get a copy of Jung's letters? On the internet, just go Carl Jung, Bill Wilson letter, and you will find any number of versions of that. I mean, the same version, but any number of places to find that. If I am ill, just like I need glasses, then there is no guilt around my illness. I cannot beat myself up over it. But it says this in the Big Book: once a certain point is reached, and other places describing the difference between a heavy drink and the real alcoholic, isn't it my fault, my choices that created this illness? I don't know. I don't think there's an answer to that. I personally, I have no proof of this, believe that I have some gene makeup which is different from others, and that the way I have lived my life led to this physical disability. That's my own personal feeling. I don't think there's any research that will ever show that, especially because there's no controlled substance. Even for alcoholism, there's no research that shows it. There's a group of people who believe, and we're trying to make it into a medical thing, a bunch of OAers. Is that what you want to tell me about?
Well, actually, there's new research that shows that something like 68% of eating disorders do have a genetic disposition.
Okay, so 68% of eating. But, correlation does not prove causation. I don't think there will ever be able to be peer-reviewed studies, especially of compulsive eating, because we're all different. And scientists need to have a controlled substance and placebos and blind tests and all that. So I don't really care. I found a solution by believing that this is true, by believing that even my eating behaviors are so ingrained in me that 40 years of therapy wouldn't get rid of them, so that they're physical in the sense that I can't stop them. And I don't care with the semantics of this issue. I don't care the cause of it. I know that there are some things that I have indulged in the past, both foods, combinations of foods, ingredients in foods, and eating behaviors that cause me cravings, uncontrollable, that I could not stop once I started. And that's good enough for me. I don't care if there's a scientific basis for that. Why does BB Big Book say recovered when in OA we talk only about being in recovery, not recovered? I'd sure like to know why that is true myself. But I can tell you that Blaine, who is this disciple of Charlie's and Joe's, I went up to him when he gave a wonderful OA Big Book study, and I said, it must be nice to be in AA and be able to say you're recovered, because the Big Book uses the word recovered in 11 places and uses the word recovering only to describe a person who's just started the steps. But recovered to describe the person who's already worked the steps and has found a solution. And I said to him, it must be nice to be in a fellowship where you can use the word recovered. He said, are you kidding? I'm crucified every time I use the word. They yell at me and scream at me. So I don't know. The big book is clear, recovered. You said that you ask a sponsee to list the foods that they can't imagine living without, then what? What is your suggestion in creating a plan of eating? This is yesterday. What is your suggestion? I think there might be a problem, because unless it's my hearing aid that's going. No. What is your suggestion to... Yeah, there's a problem. What is your suggestion to the sponsee once they've created this list? What do you ask them to do? You know, I'll stand a bit further and I'll project my voice even more for at least the short time it will take to fix this. In developing a plan of eating with a sponsee, I start off with, give me the list of things you can't imagine ever giving up forever. Give me a list of things that you've clearly not been able to put down at times, that you've just eaten buckets of or tubs of or, you know, things. Just, let's start with that list. Give me a list of your dietary preferences. Are you vegan? Are you keto? Are you paleo? Have you read some book that tells you that you should use your blood type or whatever? I must tell you, I'm not a fan of a lot of these things, but I don't care. If people want to believe that, they can. It doesn't bother me. That's the universe within which we're now going to decide what you're going to abstain from. Because even within that universe, there may be still some things you should be abstaining. Obviously, if you're going to... I don't need enough about some of these things. But if you're going to follow a specific diet, whether it's gray sheet or whether it's something else, you will eliminate a whole bunch of things that probably cause your problems. You also may be eliminating a whole bunch of things that don't cause your problems, but at least you'll be eliminating some things that cause your problems. But now that we know the universe within which, or the context within which, you're going to work out your plan of eating...
Is it still going enough?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. 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 By the way, John is recording this. So there will be a recording of what I'm saying with a whole bunch of editing, because it's a continuous recording. People have come up to me, talked to me, I've talked. Can you hear me in the back? Can you there in the back hear me? There's a very old cartoon, a New Yorker cartoon, when Gandhi was alive and there were this, you know, these hundreds of thousands of people, you know, in front of him, this picture of Gandhi in front. Can you there in the back hear me? You know, I don't know if you ever saw Monty Python, The Life of Brian, and the Sermon on the Mount with people who can't hear very well. What does he mean, blessed are the cheesemakers? You know, and so he says, well, he doesn't just mean cheesemakers, he means anyone involved in the dairy industry, you know. Anyway, so... So I start off with, and I then say, are there some foods that you believe you shouldn't be eating, that you know deep down in your heart are your problem? So I end up with this list, and then I start to work with them on an analysis. What are your volume problems? Because so many of us have volume issues, either under-eating or overeating, that are related to eating behaviors and not necessarily foods. You know, someone says, I overeat everything. Well, I test that. Do you overeat radishes? I can't stop eating bread. I say, is it bread or what you put on the bread? I can't stop eating pasta. Is it pasta or is it the Alfredo sauce on the pasta as opposed to the tomato sauce? You know, I mean, I think it deserves that kind of analysis, because people who just hang on to what they hear in OA, oh, sugar and flour, they hang on, they say, pasta's bad for me. Pasta's bad for me. Why? Because it's, you know, if you look at the diets, they will tell you pasta's not good for you because it doesn't have a lot of fiber. Because it's full of white flour with and okay, I hope this better. It's, you know, white flour isn't nutritionally valid, you know, except for some of the vitamins that are put into it. Might as well get those vitamins somewhere else. I mean, there are all kinds of reasons why you would want to adopt, as I have, a high fiber, a low fat diet. There's all kinds of good dietary reasons, but that's not why. What I abstain from, I have lots of good reasons, in my opinion, why one shouldn't eat animal products. But that's my business, not yours. But what is it that causes me cravings? I've never overeaten radishes, but if I put a creamy sauce on radishes, that'll cover the radishes enough for me to eat more of them. And radishes certainly have a crunchiness that my body seems to like. Because I have noticed my body has oral gratification needs. It likes to chew, it likes to suck, it likes to crunch, sometimes likes creamy. And so I go through all of this and working that out. Now, if they have to lose weight or if they have to gain weight, I work out volume issues. How are you going to deal with volume to make sure that you either gain the weight you need or you lose the weight you need to lose? And sometimes I told you how I adopted this concept of being full up to my belly button. It's a false concept, but it works for me, as opposed to being full up to my neck. I have a very close friend in this program who says, I have no idea where my belly button is when I'm full. I need to weigh and measure. And he does. He weighs to the micro ounce or whatever. I don't care how you do it. And the nice thing is when you get to step 10, you'll be able to rethink it. You know, I don't hold with the red light, yellow light, green light. I hold with the red light and yellow and green light when it comes to the first 9 steps. If in doubt, keep it out. When you get to step 10, you can decide whether to take it back. But why screw around on this thing? Why not be as hard as you can for a short time while you work the steps? So that's what I say to my sponsees. I hope that answers the question. I'll be happy to answer it too. But it's a very individualistic thing. I really focus on the individual because I really get upset is probably the word when I hear in a way about how people just adopt the things they read in books or the things that they're told that they should adopt. You know, there are lots of good diets. There are lots of lousy diets out there. You know, the nutritionist who was asked to review plans of eating in the dignity of choice, when given the gray sheet, said, I cannot accept this as it is. It is nutritionally unsound. I have to add, I forgot what she had to add, but she had to add something. And she was someone who was very much in tune with OA practices, but said that that particular diet eliminated certain nutritional things. Who am I to say? But that's irrelevant. You have to have it nutritionally sound, and you also, if you have to lose weight, have to have less than your body needs, so your body will eat itself, eat the fat in itself. I've been asked, I've been in program many years, I've been in relapse for at least a year. I keep praying for willingness and surrender. What else to do in the meantime? Every day I break my abstinence starting around midday. You know what, I'll give you a slight preview of my approach to that, but I will save this for the step 12 part. But I've got to tell you, I believe there are only 2 reasons for relapse based on the big book's approach to the problem. It may be, and there are a lot of people who don't like to hear this, it may be that your real problem is that not that you've relapsed, but you've never been abstinent because your plan of eating still includes things that you should be abstaining from. And I think that's true for a lot of people in this program. They allow themselves to eat foods which they shouldn't be eating or indulge in eating behaviors that they shouldn't be indulging in because they accept someone else's definition of a plan of eating for what they should be having because it's easier for them. So the body may be involved and you may never have been in relapse. You may not be in relapse because you've never been abstinent. The other thing is the way you're working the steps is not working for you. If you've truly been abstinent, and you've tried to work the steps, then the way in which you've worked the steps hasn't worked for you because you haven't reached the point guaranteed by the end of step 9 where you don't want to go back to the stuff you've given up. So try another way of doing the steps. Maybe do them a little bit harder. Maybe do them with life or death. Maybe get new hope in you. And then, as I said yesterday, I would say that you need 3 plans. You need a plan of eating that's honest and direct and absolutely eliminates what you shouldn't be eating. You can do that either by restricting what you do eat or eliminating or restricting what you don't or setting out what you don't eat. In other words, you could have a plan of eating like in the Dignity of Choice where you have only so much protein and so much carbohydrates and things of that sort, either low or high carbohydrates or low or high protein or whatever's in there. And you could just say, I will choose from this group of vegetables and this group of grains and this group of proteins and nothing else, in which case you will be eliminating a whole bunch of things that cause you problems. Or you could just say, I will eat anything other than. And that's what I do. And I will eat only when I do this. So I restrict it that way. Other people restrict it by restricting what goes into their bodies completely. I don't think it matters. Well, the first is the body. You may never have been in relapse because you may not have abstained. And the second thing is your mind has not changed, and you are in fact relapsing, and that means you're not doing the steps the way that works for you. Three plans. One is the plan of eating. Second is a timetable to work the steps. And a realistic but also real life or death kind of timetable where you're saying, I'm committing myself that this is the number one priority in my life aside from immediate family needs or immediate work needs. And I will devote my off time to working on this because this is life or death. Even that commitment itself is worth it. But it gives you hope to say, I only have to hang on for 2 months or 1 month or 3 months. I don't have to hang on for the rest of my life because I'm going to give this only 3 months or 2 months. Sometimes it means getting yourself a step five person and making an appointment with that person and working backwards. And saying, oh boy, if I'm going to meet with so-and-so on October the 10th, I'd better get my other work done before, you know, finish my step four, setting yourself a deadline. The way in which the big book does the steps will give you some sense of how long you might need to do that. But the idea of saying, I'm on this diet, call it a diet, who cares what you want to call it, but it's the equivalent of being on a diet for X number of months or X number of weeks and saying, okay, I can handle it for a short time, and the payoff, I hope, will be that I won't want to stop it. You know? But in 3 months' time, I can have that pie. In 3 months' time, I can eat that cheesecake or whatever it is that you want. I can do that unless I don't want to. And let's see how the steps work. And the third is a strategy, a day-to-day strategy. People do a lot of phoning in OA, and a lot of ways of doing the steps. They phone in their food and they phone in any changes if circumstances change on a day-to-day basis. That works for a lot of people. I would say to people, don't do it with me. I don't need your phone call. I've recovered and I've have enough time carrying the message to others. But pick a person who could use you as a role model. Pick a person who's still struggling and say, could I phone you every day and phone in my food to you and phone you if I have any problems? Other strategies. Don't watch TV at night. Don't eat while you're watching TV. Throw out of your house anything for the next month, 2 months, 3 months, anything that might tempt you. Don't go out to eat. If you are tempted, leave. If you're tempted, phone someone. If you're tempted, say, I'll eat it in 20 minutes and I'll have a glass of water, two glasses of water before, and then I'll wait 20 minutes and see if I still want it. Say, I'll take it home to my sponsor. I'll put it in the doggy bag and I'll eat it tonight. Whatever it takes. I mean, there are all kinds of strategies, and you have to work out the ones that make sense to you based on your own circumstances. With those three things, a plan of eating that truly eliminates what you should be eliminating to the best of your knowledge, you can add to it as time goes on, but that you're absolutely honest with yourself, a sense of a short period of time within which to work the steps and the impetus to do it, and some day-to-day strategy, that should help you keep on track. Now, you may still relapse, in which case you figure out, well, what was wrong in my strategy? Maybe I should be working the steps even harder, or maybe I should, if I look back, Ruth is a big book workshop person, talks about your decision to go drive to that drive-thru and take out the fast food was the result of a whole bunch of decisions that you made, how you left, what street you took when you left work, whether you went one way or another, your even decision to take the car out. I mean, work backwards and see what kind of decisions you were making that led you to the final act of eating that first compulsive bite, and then figure out which strategy could prevent that. Make use of all the experience in OA. Go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Use all the online resources that are available, all the telephone meetings that are available. Whatever it takes, do. Many alcoholics will spend all their time in AA club rooms to shield themselves from temptation while they're working the steps. I hope that answers that question. I'll talk some more when we talk about sponsoring. Someone asked to take a picture of the provocations. Well, they're available in the book. It's available for free download on that website. Okay? And you can get them there. And if someone wants to come up, I have that book, and someone can take a picture of them. Okay. Now, that ornamental clock in the back is so disconcerting because I'm looking at it, it's always 7:30. Or is it working? If it is, it's just wrong. Okay. So we're now at the chapter, We Agnostics. And there are, every time I do a big workshop, people thank me for talking about agnosticism and atheism. Because I will tell you very frankly, being a person who does not believe in a divine or supernatural being, who would class himself only because I've studied enough philosophy to know that I'll never really know, even though I think most people would think of me as an atheist. As a person like that, I can tell you that that in OA, the Christian God is taken so for granted that people think that we should all accept that. And it really does turn off many of us in a way that doesn't carry the message of the openness of this program. This program is open to anyone, including people who don't believe in any kind of a supernatural deity. And the Big Book even has instructions on how to carry the message when we get to the chapter working with others about not using specific theological terms so as not to prejudice people. We're delicate, damaged people, and we come in looking for help. And don't assume that the God that you have is going to be the right God for everyone. I just tell you that. On the other hand, if you're deeply religious and you still are compulsively eating, this chapter tells you exactly why you're still why God isn't helping you. And tells you why the solution of the 12 steps will find your God helping you. I'll leave that in suspense because it's toward the end of the chapter. But you have to read this chapter if you are deeply religious or in any way or deeply spiritual and believe in some supernatural deity. You have to read this for two reasons. One is it explains why, if you're still compulsively eating, why you still are, even though you do believe. The other is that you're going to be talking to people like me. And you have a duty to talk to people like me. You can't just say, I will only, you know, I'm Jewish and I will only, I'm Orthodox Jewish, so I will only sponsor people who are Orthodox Jews. That's denying your step 12 responsibilities. And you have to be able to talk to anyone. I find myself at times talking to Orthodox Jews, even though I am so far away from being an Orthodox Jew that many of them would consider me to be almost Christian in character. I talk to Buddhists, I talk to atheists, agnostics, fundamental Christians, literal Christians. I don't know what the opposite of literal Christians are, but you know, the more established denominations, if you will. It doesn't matter to me. And one of my best friends in this program before she passed away was a Mormon, and that's about as far from what I believe in as you can be. And yet we got along fine. We both spoke about God. Her God was very different from my God, but who cares? She had found hers, I had found mine. And that's what this program is really all about. That's what step 12, God as we understood him. Okay, so how do you reconcile your atheism with the concept of a higher power? I will answer that. Did you say you only needed a personality change and did not need to believe in a higher power? If so, what is the power greater than you that has restored you? To whom, what did you turn your will and your life over to? All in good time. I will discuss those issues. I mean, it is hard for some people who devoutly believe in God to understand how someone like me can have this personality change and can have some fundamental belief. And this chapter explains it all. And explains it, I think, to the satisfaction. Well, it does explain to the satisfaction of someone who has studied a great deal of philosophy, has read a lot of theology, and has really considered the issue at great length. I mean, don't debate with me the existence of God. I can debate that with you, and I have studied the proofs for the existence of God and the proofs for the non-existence of God, and both of them are flawed, as the philosopher that's had a tremendous influence on me, Immanuel Kant, shows in his book, The Critique of Pure Reason. You can, side by side, the proof for the existence of God and proof against the existence of God, side by side, they both make absolute sense, and they're both wrong. And actually, Kant said, I have to get rid of knowledge in order to make room for faith. He was a devout Christian. And he wanted to get rid of this concept of trying to prove God's existence and wanted just people to have faith in God's existence. Of course, the influence he had over me is to have no faith in God's existence, but that's another issue. Okay. So, we agnostics, page 44. In the preceding chapters, you've learned something of alcoholism. We hope we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. And here is their distinction. If, when you honestly want to, you find you can't quit entirely, that's the mental obsession. You want to stop drinking and you just keep going back to it. Or if, when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, that's the physical cravings, your body wants more, you're probably alcoholic. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Now, Joe and Charlie, you know, point out that AA has a pamphlet called 44 Questions to See If You're an Alcoholic. We have a 15 Questions to See If You're a Compulsive Eater. Big Book has two. Do you have an allergy to the body that has the craving, that develops cravings? Do you have a mental obsession that keeps sending you back? Can you stop once you've started? Can you stop from starting? If you can't stop once you started and you can't stop from starting, you're an alcoholic. You're a compulsive eater. You're an addict. And they go on and they say on page 45, the bottom of page 44, top of page 45, they say, if all we needed was a code of morals, even if you're an atheist or agnostic, that should be sufficient. But it's not. Obviously, we have no power. Page 45, lack of power. That was our dilemma. That's step one, problem. Our problem, the problem is we have no power. We have no hope. We are in despair. On our own, we are clearly powerless over our addiction. By the way, I should have pointed out, the step as written on the wall is, we admitted we are powerless over food, - that our lives have become unmanageable. Not and that our lives have become unmanageable, but that our lives have become unmanageable. From a grammatic point of view, the phrase that our lives have become unmanageable modifies the sentence, we admitted we were powerless over food. You don't have to agree, and I certainly would never have agreed when I joined OA, that my life was unmanageable. I was managing very well. I was in a law practice that was successful. I was loved. I had friends. Everything was well, but I couldn't deal with food. I was completely powerless over food. Now, if I look back, sure, it was affecting my life in many ways, but that's not what I had to agree to. I had to agree that on the one hand, I couldn't stop from once I started. I had the problem of the cravings, and I couldn't stop from starting again, the mental obsession. That double whammy, that vicious circle. They go on, lack of power, that was our dilemma, step one. And I hope you see that you don't take step one, you just acknowledge it. My God, I have no power. I agree, I have no power. We have to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. Obviously it has to be greater than me, because I have no power in me. Remember Bill said he had no power in him, he had power now, but obviously he had no power in himself. We're talking about Abby. And obviously is the second shortest sentence in the big book. But where and how are we to find this power? That's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. Not help you solve your problem, but which will solve your problem. And then they say that means we have to talk about God, and that's going to create all kinds of prejudices, and it does. So many of us read this and say, God, I this meaningless concept. Page 46, right in the middle, we have agnostic temperament. Have had these thoughts and experiences. Let us make haste to reassure you. We found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results, even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God. Much to our relief, we discovered we did not need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect a contact with him. As soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, I can't deny the possible existence, but it has no meaning to me. We began to be possessed of a new power, sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps. I don't know if any of you remember the Saturday Night Live recurring Chicago Bears fans would sit around with vast mounds of ribs and hams and stuff, and anytime, you know, what's the greatest football team of all time? The Bears, you know. So every so often you'll hear me say, the steps. So this is one of them. Provided we took other simple steps. The steps. We found that God doesn't make too hard terms with those who seek him. Some of this language is off-putting to someone like me. I'm a third generation secular Jew. My grandparents rejected the religion of their parents. They were activists, they were Jews, very much Jews, and very much secular Jews, very much immersed in the culture, as I hope I am, but didn't believe in the God, didn't believe in the prayers. I've never fasted on Yom Kippur. So some of this language is hard to read, but page 47, they do their best. When therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. This applies too to other spiritual expressions which you find in this book. Don't let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you, stop you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. We need to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? Take off the capital P and I'm willing to say yes. Put it back on, I don't like it. As soon as a man can say that he does believe or is willing to believe, we emphatically assure him he's on his way. It's been repeatedly proven among us that upon the simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. Asterisk, read Appendix 2. Personality change sufficient to overcome addiction, our addiction. So they do their best to say, we're using terms, but it's your own conception, not our conception. Okay. Page 48. The reader may still ask why he should believe in a power greater than himself. So it's willingness that all that's required. Remember, Bill said, on upon a foundation of willingness, I can build. So I don't have to believe in anything. Step two is a statement of the end result of the solution. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Not that we have to believe before we started the steps, the rest of the steps. We came to believe. It describes the solution. Step one is the problem. We're powerless. Step two is the solution. We got power. We have recovered and have power. And that power has restored us to sanity. So I am willing to believe, by looking at all the recovered people in OA and AA and all the other addictive fellowships, addiction 12-step fellowships, that there is available to me, through working the 12 steps, a power that will create a personality change in me sufficient to overcome my addiction. I'm willing to believe that that happens because I've seen it happen in people who used to be like me and are no longer like me. And that's all I need, that little faint hope that's there for me to start the steps. Because I'm not going to find that power until after I finish step 9. There's nothing that happens to me. There's no promise that's given to me relating to a higher power. Absolute guarantee until you get to step 9, where you're given all kinds of guarantees of how you're going to feel. And so this whole thing that we sometimes have where suddenly we have to sort of take step 2, and that means that we have to sort of will ourselves to turn everything over to believe in God, and step 3 we have to turn it over to God. That's not the big book approach. The big book approach is step 1 is problem, step 2 is solution. Step 1 is despair, step 2 is hope. Step 1 is powerlessness, step 2 is power. Step 3 is only a decision. It is not the action required to go forward with that decision. So step 3 is only a moment in time where you say, okay, I'm willing to go along with the rest. That's better, isn't it? Willing to go along with the rest of the steps. That's all it is. Nothing more. Nothing less, but nothing more than that. And we have this big thing about step three that suddenly we take step three and suddenly we're in a whole new world of life. Not true. Big Book doesn't promise that at all. If I decide to come to Seattle or Osaka, I can make that decision all I want, but if I don't get a plane ticket and get on a plane, I ain't coming here. And if I decide to turn my will and my life over, if I make a decision to do that and I don't do the steps that are necessary to go through with that decision isn't going to come towards me. And Big Book is really clear about that. And that's where ahead of ourselves. On page 48, the Big Book says, the reader may still ask why he should believe in a power greater than himself. We think there are good reasons. Let's have a look at some of them. I have a friend who's a philosophy professor. He's read a lot more philosophy than I have. A lot more. And I gave him these proofs, and he said, second-rate philosophy. It's good enough for me. I'm a second-rate philosopher. But there are three reasons, proofs that it's worthwhile for you to be willing to take the steps. Because that's all step two is a willingness to take the steps. Willingness to search for this higher power. And the first reason is found from the beginning of page 48 to the top paragraph of page 51. And this is based on sort of the scientific principle that a theory that explains reality is worth believing in until it doesn't explain reality anymore. So the theory of gravity explained reality until people had such sensitive instruments that they could show that they needed relativity to explain gravity and other things. And I don't know enough to talk about quantum physics or string theory to be able to go anything beyond saying, and evidently we need something else to explain beyond the theory of relativity. But scientists posit hypotheses, theories, ideas, and then they set out to prove or disprove them by criteria that show that they either work or they don't work. If we were to be able to go back in time, which I think has been proved we can't do, but if we were able to go back in time, grab someone who lived in the 14th century and bring that person here and show that person a light switch and turn a light on and off, he would think we were magicians, witches, whatever, because there's no theory. Well, I don't know about you. I've never seen an electron. I've never seen electrons move on a conductive thing like copper wire. And yet I believe absolutely that electricity is caused by the joining of the movement of electrons in a circuit that heats up a bulb or I don't know how LEDs work, so I don't even know how they work, but I'm sure that there's a theory about how they work and it's all explainable by physical concepts. I'm willing to believe the scientists know exactly how they work, and I accept that it isn't magic when that light bulb is turned on and off. So a theory that works is worth believing in. That's the first argument. And they go on and say, well, our theory is if you have our problem and you work the steps, you will have what we have. And look at us. We had your problem. We no longer have your problem. And we're telling you that the way we got to where we are is we worked the steps. That's a pretty good argument. That's a good enough argument for most of us. Just right off the bat, a theory that works is worth believing in. And they talk about electricity. There are all kinds of other concepts in there. But on page 50, right in the middle, it says, there are many different approaches to the power greater than yourself. And they say on one proposition, these men and women are strikingly agreed. Every one of them has gained access to and believes in a power greater than himself. That's the theory. This power has in each case accomplished the miraculous, the humanly impossible. That's the fact. The fact is they used to be like me, in despair, no power, and now they have power. Here are thousands of men and women, worldly indeed, they flatly declare that since they have come to believe in a power greater than themselves, to take a certain attitude toward that power, and to do certain simple things, the steps, there has been a revolutionary change in their way of living and thinking. Okay? That's the first argument. And just to show, top of page 51, leaving aside, they show how the change came over them. When many hundreds of people are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important factor of their lives, they present a powerful reason why one should have faith. Now, notice it doesn't say sobriety is the most important thing in their lives. It's the consciousness of the presence of God. Why? Because if you are conscious of the presence of God and in communion with the power greater than yourself, you will be sane. If you are sane, you will recognize that the behaviors and the foods and the food ingredients that you have abstained from are poison to you. And no sane person eats poison. So I don't concentrate on my abstinence at all. I concentrate on my relationship with my higher power. What higher power? Let's read on. The next argument starts at page 51 and goes on to approximately page 53. And this is another side of the same scientific argument. The only advances in science have occurred when people are willing to think outside the boxes that they're in. It's a whole book related to that, The Structure of Scientific Experiment, Thomas Kuhn. I think that's what it's called.
Where is that again?
I'm giving you, it starts on page 51, I'm giving you the summary of it.
What is that summary again?
The summary is that the only improvement or scientific inventions that have occurred with people willing to think outside the box, to think new thoughts. If you think the world is flat, you will not be able to navigate around it. You know? Just, I saw a wonderful sign supposedly from the Flat Earth Society. The Flat Earth Society believes that the earth is flat and we have branches all over the globe. anyway. So that's the, you know, they say, students of ancient history tell us that the intellect of men in the old days was equal to the best, but material progress was painfully slow. The spirit of modern scientific inquiry, research, and invention was almost unknown. People's minds were fettered by superstition. The round earth was preposterous. Galileo was almost put to death for his astronomical heresies, for saying that the earth might be revolving around the sun rather than the sun revolving around the earth. And they say, we asked ourselves, are not some of us just as biased and unreasonable about the realm of the spirit as were the ancients about the realm of the material? And they talk about Kitty Hawk, and I actually have a fascinating quote from the New York Times. There was this, Professor Langley was a great scientist who was trying his best to have a flying machine that heavier than air that could fly. And on December the 8th, he tried from a catapult, and it fell right into the Potomac River. I think that's how you pronounce it. And he was criticized for his waste of money. New York Times editorial, December 10th, 1903. We hope that Professor Langley will not put his substantial greatness as a scientist in further peril by continuing to waste his time and the money involved in further airship experiments. Life is short, and he is capable of services to humanity incomparably greater than can be expected to result from trying to fly. For students and investigators of the Langley type, there are more useful employments. 7 days later, two bicycle mechanics who did not read the New York Times flew a heavier-than-air flying machine. Now, it's the willingness to think outside the box. And the big book goes on and says, well, you know, you may think we're going to fly to the moon in 1939. Well, we will someday, and we did. Well, you did. And on page 52 are some important words. We have to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems this same readiness to change our point of view. So that's this argument. Change your point of view, and you may find a solution that you couldn't see from where you are. If you're standing behind a mountain, you can't see what's on the other side. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was. So these are the bedevilments. There are eight of them. And when we saw others solve their problems by simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we have to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas didn't work, but the God idea did. And I point out that we can be logical, but logic doesn't work. It's, you know, if logic worked, we would logically say, why would I eat this stuff? It's poison to me. But clearly our logical minds, and we atheists and agnostics are people who want to be logical. That's why we reject the idea of something beyond rational thought. It's not working for us. So why don't we change our point of view? And on page 53, they point out, you atheists and agnostics, you have a choice. And it says, when we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis. Remember that bitter morass of self-pity? Self-imposed crisis. Because the solution's available to us. And if we continue in the problem, it's self-imposed. That we couldn't postpone. We had to fearlessly face the proposition. Either God is everything or else he's nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was our choice to be? The words are not easy for people like me. But the idea, if you accept that the word God stands for your own conception of a power greater than yourself, I can accept that. And I've been in this program long enough not to care anymore. But I've got to tell you, in the early days, it was hard to read. A lot of translation had to be done. They say, arrived at this point, we were squarely confronted with the question of faith. We couldn't duck the issue. Some of us had already walked far over the bridge of reason toward the desired shore of faith. The outlines, and I love this image, the outlines of the promise of the new land had brought luster to tired eyes and fresh courage to flagging spirits. Friendly hands had stretched out a welcome. We were grateful that reason had brought us so far, but somehow we couldn't quite step ashore. Perhaps we'd been leaning too heavily on reason. That last mile, we didn't like to lose our support. I understand that concept, and as a matter of fact, a great Danish philosopher, Søren Kierkegaard, came up. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I just say real quick, one acronym for God, Gift of Desperation.
Gift of Desperation. Okay, thank you. So the concept is that at times we have to take what Kierkegaard called a leap of faith. Well, I call it in Danish something. I don't know what he called it, but in English it's a leap of faith. That once reason doesn't, it takes us only so far, but it can't take us any further. And this leap of faith is the flying into the unknown. And that's what this second argument is all about, this leap of faith. Just saying, I'm going to change my position and try again. Indiana Jones, and is it the Temple of Doom where they're running from the bad guys and they, you know, walk, turn right and then walk over the bridge of faith, and they walk up, they just, it looks like it's a chasm in front of them, and there's the one with Sean Connery. And then they turn out it's a heavily camouflaged bridge. Well, I mean, it's beautiful movie making, ridiculous in reality when you think about it. But that whole idea that you are willing to take the faith. I did this. I used to be like you. I'm different from what you are like now because I have recovered. Do what I did and you'll have what I have. That's the argument. Change your point of view. And then the third argument is for me the most powerful. And it actually helped me to find a power greater than myself, to define one. That was natural, but let us think, right at the bottom, page 53, but let us think a little bit more closely. Without knowing it, had we not been brought to where we stood by a certain kind of faith, didn't we believe in our own reasoning, didn't we have confidence in our ability to think, or was that but a sort of faith? Well, that's a cute argument. But the next one is much more powerful. We found, too, that we had been worshippers. What a state of mental goose flesh that used to bring on. Had we not variously, that meaning in various ways, worshipped people, sentiment, things, money, and ourselves? And then with a better motive, had we not worshipfully beheld the sunset, the sea, or a flower? Who of us had not loved something or somebody? How much of these feelings, these loves, these worships have to do with pure reason? Little or nothing, we saw at last. I wish they'd say, yet were not these things the tissue out of which our lives were constructed. Did not these feelings, after all, determine the course of our existence? It was impossible to say we had no capacity for love or faith, for faith or love or worship. In one form or another, we've been living by faith and little else. You know, they say, imagine life without faith, where nothing left but pure reason, it wouldn't be life. Everything that is truly important to me in this world has nothing to do with logic or reason. Why do I love my daughters and my grandchildren more than I love you, for instance? I don't have an answer to that question. you know, I held them as babies. What logic is behind that love? What logic is behind the fact that when I picked them up, I was in the birthing room, when I picked them up, I knew I'd die for them. I didn't even know them. There's no logic in that. There's no logic that explains why the music of Johann Sebastian Bach can give me ecstasy. I don't know why or how it works. It doesn't to some of you, it does to me. So where is the logic in all that? And if I had to make a choice between saving the world and saving one of my daughters, I'd save one of my daughters. Where's the logic behind that? You know, so as logical as I want to be, the reality is everything that's important to me is not logical at all. And I cannot justify it by any moral reasoning whatsoever. And therefore, I do live on faith. I live on something. There is something that is more powerful than I am that I cannot justify. I just don't call it God. Because I don't believe it acts in this world. But I believe in something. And I would be hypocritical to say that I don't. So my first sponsor, thank goodness he did this. He asked me the simplest question in the world. Is there anything that is more important than you are? Well, I come from a family of people who have been very active in social and political causes. I come from a family that, for whom the truth was absolutely significant. I come from a family of love. I embody these principles as much as I can, and appreciation of beauty. And I said to my sponsor after a couple of days of thought, didn't need that long, truth, love, justice, and beauty. These are more important than I am. I will die. These will abide. And he said, call that God. I said, but truth, love, justice, and beauty aren't going to find me the parking spots that other people say that they find. You know, truth, love, justice, and beauty aren't going to, you know, do anything to me. I said, that's your higher power. And I look at it this way. You know, that clock does work. It's just wrong. Because it's 8 o'clock now, according to that clock. I look at it this way. A lot of people who are religious get direction from their God by trying to understand what the message from their God is, from scriptures, from their interpreters and stuff like that. In a sense, they're told where to go. They're pushed from behind, go in this direction. My direction is not like that. I look at the choices available to me as if I were on a compass with 360 degrees. One direction is the way of truth, love, justice, and beauty, and all the others are Laurie's way, to greater or lesser degree, depending whether I'm going, you know, 180 degrees the other direction or, you know, 20 degrees and or whatever. And so I look at truth, love, justice, and beauty as the equivalent of something that pulls me rather than pushes me. And as long as I can make that translation of words or translation of my mind, thank you very much, then that is sufficient for me to be able to accept it. So those of you who do not believe in any supernatural deity, and by supernatural I'm not making fun of it, I'm just saying something above nature, something that can change things in you and in others, as many of I'm sure in this room do believe in, and I don't, at least I can accept the concept that there are things that I want to be guided by, that I want to work in the direction of truth, love, justice, and beauty rather than in my way. And that is the introduction to the Big Book's explanation of what it is that these steps do to all of us, regardless of whether we believe in a specific kind of God, or we believe in a creative intelligence, or we believe in a spirit of the universe, or we believe in our deepest values, like, for me, truth, love, justice, and beauty. For you, it may be something else. And here's what the Big Book says, page 55, in the paragraph beginning, actually, we were fooling ourselves. Actually, we were fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured, blocked off by calamity, bad things happening to us, by pomp, a sense of self-importance, by worship of other things, people's opinions of us, money, prestige. But in some form or other, it is there. They go on, they say, we finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. And, you know, accepting that God can mean whatever my concept of a higher power is, I accept absolutely that faith in something is part of my makeup. I cannot question the love I feel for my daughters, although the older one between the ages of 12 and 16 certainly tested that. She's an absolutely incredible person today and doesn't really remember what was going on with her during those times, at least she says. I just can't question that, because I can't question the love I feel or the dedication I have to the idea of truth or justice or beauty. They say sometimes we have to search fearlessly, searching in fearless moral inventory, and we'll see that this searching in fearless moral inventory is not just step four, but it's steps 4 through 9. But he was there. He was much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. It was so with us. Deep down within us is this fundamental idea of our deepest values. Whether you choose to call it a specific kind of God, or I choose to call it my deepest values, it doesn't matter. We all have them. They're things that are just part of us, and we cannot question them because they're beyond questioning. They would make us. All the steps do is clear the channel. Get rid of the obscurity, the blockage between what we most deeply believe in and how we think and act. So that you who believe in a particular kind of God, those of you who do believe in a particular kind of God, if you ask why isn't God doing for you what you ask, the answer is because you have blocked up the channel between God and you. And the steps will unblock that channel, unblock the pipeline. It's the drainal of the drain cleaner that you need, if I could be a little down to earth. It's the plunger. The step 9 is the plunger of the soul. But that's the whole concept. And that's as simple as you can get. It's the answer for the Christian, it's the answer for the Jew, for the religious person, the non-religious person, for the person who ultimately... Listen, if atheists and agnostics didn't believe in the truth, they wouldn't argue. You know, I mean, obviously it's important. If skepticism weren't a value, if being open to new ideas weren't a value, they wouldn't argue. So clearly truth is important. And for most of us, love is important. And for many of us, beauty is important. And a sense of justice is important. But for others, all those deepest values are embodied in the God they of their own religion. And why shouldn't it be? You know, and so it doesn't matter whether it's a particular kind of God or a general kind of God or just ideas or concepts or moral values. What it is your fundamental beliefs, and all that the steps do is clear the passageway so that you are living according to what you believe in. And this becomes clearer as we work the steps, as we go on in the steps. So we're going to go to chapter 5, how it works. I have another 20 minutes, according to the clock.
Excuse me. So those were the three arguments.
The three arguments for the atheist and the agnostic is, one, a theory that works is worth believing in. The steps work. It's worth believing in. Second is, get out of the rut you're in and try something new, because that's the only way you'll ever get progress. Here's your rut. You'll be set by the bedevilments. You can't be of much use. You're eating, you're drinking too much. You're eating too much. You're eating too little. You can't, you know, you're in a terrible shape. Try something new. You know, there's a, I'll tell you the theory in a second, but there's an old Jewish joke, and I guess it has to be Jewish. There's a play going on, serious play. And in the middle of one scene, suddenly an actor collapses. And for a while, the actors all try to play around this and try to pretend that that's part of the play. But it becomes pretty obvious that this guy is not resuscitating. And so they close the curtain. The manager is their doctor in the house. The doctor goes behind stage. The lights go on. Turmoil, a little bit of noise, turmoil. the doctor and the manager come out and say, this wonderful man, this actor, has died. Give him some chicken soup, comes the yell from the audience. The man has died. We are so sorry. We cannot go on. You'll get refunds. We don't know what we're going to do tomorrow or the next day. But the play cannot go on. Please file orderly and get refunds. Give him some chicken soup. Doctor leans over and says, the man is dead. The answer is, can't hurt. That's how you should look at the steps. Can't hurt, you know. What do you got to lose by working the steps? Really? You may lose a few pounds if you have to lose pounds. You may gain a few pounds if you have to gain pounds. And maybe, just maybe, and almost certainly, if you follow the directions, you will be in a different world. Your attitude toward life and your reactions to life will change. You will have a personality change sufficient to overcome your addiction. Can't hurt. Okay, I have 15 minutes, 17 minutes. Chapter 5.
Wait, the third one.
Oh, the third one. The third one is simply, you do believe in something. You say you don't. You say you're an atheist. You say you're agnostic. You say you don't believe in anything. You do believe in something. And what you do believe in is so fundamental to you that it really is what your life is based on. It's not based on a rational approach to life, because if it were rational, you wouldn't be upset if other people didn't agree with you. If it were rational, you wouldn't love some people more than others. You know, all those things. Thank you for reminding me. Chapter 5, how it works. Chapter 5, there have been the doctor's opinion and 4 other chapters before this. How many of us read that title and say, okay, and realize that the 12 steps are here, say, I'll just begin here. And as Joe and Charlie point out ad nauseum, I wouldn't say this because they're very enjoyable people to listen to, but they point out over and over again, if you're going to study a textbook, you start at the beginning. And there's a reason that the big book has spent 5 chapters, Doctor's Story, Doctor's Opinion, Bill's Story, There Is a Solution, More About Alcoholism, and We Agnostic, to talk about steps 1 and 2, especially about step 1. Because step 1 is designed to tell you, to persuade you, if you are like us, you're doomed. If you are like us. And because only if you accept that you're doomed will you reach out to the faint hope that is the steps. Why would you do this ridiculous stuff if you weren't powerless? Deeply, completely powerless. Now the answer is, and I'll talk about this in step 12, is that very often OA is a haven for comfort and love. And it isn't about the steps, it's about love and understanding beyond our wildest dreams. And that's contrary to tradition 5, which is that the role of our meetings is not to provide love and comfort. It's to provide the message of recovery to those who still suffer. And what's the recovery? Through the 12 steps. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message of recovery, as the result of these steps, to those who still suffer. And Tradition 5 picks that up. The primary purpose of every OA group is to carry the message of recovery to those, to the compulsive eater who still suffers. So while we may be a haven for people who have suffered a great deal, and I would never take away that haven, if we forget that our job is not to provide a safe haven, but to say, what step are you on? Because it's the steps that will give you the solution, not the safe haven that we're providing you, then we're missing out Tradition 5. We're really going against the combined wisdom of AA and OA on what Tradition 5 is all about. Of course we provide comfort. Of course we provide a place for people to feel comfortable. But our meetings and our actions should always be relating to the steps and how the steps give us recovery from the problems that we have. And if people have those problems, we have a solution that has worked for us, and we're willing to give it away to them for free with all the energy we have at our command, as long as they're willing to work with us. Okay. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. In the initial draft, it used to say, who have thoroughly followed our directions. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. My friend that I never met in person, the guy on the phone who said, I'm chubby, you know, I'm plump, he died. He died a few years later of compulsive eating. I had a friend in program who had lost 100 pounds right at the beginning and then just stayed 300 or 400 pounds overweight for the rest of the time I knew her. And toward the end of her life, she had stretched her skin so much that she was confined to her apartment. She couldn't wear any clothes because everything was agony to her. And she died, age of 40-something. I have a friend who has lost a lot of weight and sponsors a lot of people who have to lose a lot of weight. And he's talked to me of at least one person whom he was trying to help who died in a fire because the firefighters couldn't carry him out because he weighed so much. There are real tragedies out there, and there are people who have trouble being rigorously honest. And Bill was asked, why did you say this right at the beginning of how it works? He said, I have to be honest. That is the fact. He also points out there are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. So honesty is what's required here. And honesty is both inward and outward. Honesty to other people, but also honesty to ourselves. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened and what we're like now. If you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. The original draft said you're ready to follow directions. They remind us of two other points on page 76 and 79 that we were willing to go to any length to get recovery. At some of these, we balked. We thought if we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. You say, we doubt if you can. So at some of these, you may balk. You may think you can find an easier, softer way, but we doubt if you can. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil, nothing, until we let go absolutely. Remember the deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. You know, we often translate that, we deal with food, cunning, baffling. I don't think radishes are not cunning, baffling, and powerful to me. I like to say we deal with our trigger foods, our killer foods, our binge eating behaviors. Cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us, but there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Yeah. Half measures avail us nothing. Three-quarter measures avail us nothing. 11/12 measures avail us nothing. It's all or nothing in this program. Let's not believe that the big book says that each step is suggested. No, each step is there in order for a reason. And in half measure avail us, we stood at the turning point. He used to say, and I'm so glad they took it out, throw yourself under his care and protection, protection and care with complete abandon. I don't even like we asked, but at least it wasn't throw yourself. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Not each step, but the program is suggested. Either you take it or you don't. It's all or nothing. And when we get to these steps, let's remember, those of you who are saying, I'll never be able to apologize to that bastard, you know, because that's what I think I'm going to have to do in step 9. You're not there yet. And you may not have to apologize to that guy. You may have to report him to the police as your amends to him. So you don't know what you're going to be doing. And this afternoon, we're going to be going into real deep stuff, real heavy stuff, stuff that I don't skirt it because I have to deal with it. But I'm very humble about it because I have never suffered the traumas that people in this program have suffered. I have friends who have, and I have friends who have told me how the steps work for them, and I'll be sharing their experience with you. But and it's different from this book in the sense that this book was written by people who did bad things, as opposed to people who had bad things happen to them. So there's a lot of translating and clarifying to be done, which we'll do this afternoon. The steps have changed. The steps were originally just 6. There were Ebby's 5 plus Dr. Silkworth's powerlessness. So step one was complete deflation. Then the second step was self-analysis and an inventory. The third step was a confession to another human being. The fourth step was restitution, making up for the wrongs you've done. The fifth step was praying for knowledge and guidance. And the sixth step was helping people, especially alcoholics, without hope of reward, property, or prestige. And when Bill came to write the 12 steps, when he came to the point of writing how it works, and he knew he had to set them out in an order, he decided, and he tells a story, but he's sitting disgruntled on his living room couch or something like that, trying to write with a yellow pad. And he realizes that alcoholics love to find loopholes, and that the six steps as they were then were not enough. There were a lot of loopholes in there. So he added six more steps. And he added step two, which turns out to be a description of the solution. He added step three, which is a moment in time where you make a decision. He added step six, which was a moment in time when you think about seriously, are you willing to have God remove your defective character? He added step seven, which was asking to have your character defects removed. He split step nine into what was practically a brilliant idea. Become willing to make amends to everyone, that's step eight, but don't make amends if to do so would injure other people. And, of course, people would do that in sponsoring directly. They would say, yeah, don't phone your mother up. This is an example from our own literature. Don't phone your mother up and say, I've hated you for 20 years. You didn't know it, but now I love you. Why would you do that? You know? There's someone in this world to whom I should say I should have broken off the relationship and told you to go see a psychiatrist, but I didn't. I'm really sorry. But I'm not going to say that. And then he added step 10, which was what the Oxford groups were doing, the continuation of steps 4 through 9, and he kept 11 and 12. And he liked 12. Thought 12 was a nice number. Really quick, really, really just clarification, or put in the ask it basket. Yes?
Yeah. Can you say the original ones again?
Step 1, step 4, step 5, step 9, step 11, step 12. There were changes made in the steps, but it's not significant. Page 60. Many of us exclaimed, what an order, I can't go through with it. I don't know if any of you remember that great comedian John Kay, who comes from Los Angeles, who has a whole set of comic... He's a great speaker. Get him someday. He's a wonderful man. But he also has a comedy routine where he imagines an OA meeting where everyone's in on it except the person reading the 12 steps. And at the end of reading these 12 steps, everyone in the room gets up, what an order, I can't go through with it, and they all leave. Anyway, John Kay. I can give you his last name, but maybe this is being taped, I don't think I should. Many of us exclaimed, what an order, I can't go through with it, don't be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We're not saints. The point is we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we've set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostics, and our personal adventures before and after, it used to say, have been designed to sell you three pertinent ideas. I'm glad they changed that one. And look at these three. These are called the ABCs. That we're alcoholic could not manage our own lives. Step one. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. That's both step one and step two. And C, that God could and would if he were stopped. That's step two. And these are not steps you take. They're just ideas which you accept wholeheartedly. And then it used to say, if you're not convinced on these points, reread this book or throw it away. And I kind of wish that had been kept. Anyway, it says, being convinced we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood him. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? And here's where subheadings would be very helpful, because the big book says, what does it mean to turn our will and our life over, and then what do we do? And the answer is, they first discuss turning our will over, then they discuss turning our life over, and then they tell you what to do, which is to say the step three and quickly go on with the rest of the steps. Not to stay at step three at all. So for the next 2 or 3 minutes, I'll give you an overview of that, and then I'll come back when we come back at, when do we come back, 1:30? Yeah. And when we come back at 1:30, I'll finish up step three, and we'll do 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and I hope 10. The overview is this. Our problem is that we have wanted to be in charge of life, and life has not gone our way. Sometimes our motives are absolutely pure. We just want other people to be happy, not ourselves. Well, it'll make us happy if other people are happy. We just want life to go on well. I mean, as a Jewish kid growing up in the 50s, the Holocaust was just like this burden that so many of us lived with, even though no one in my family suffered from it, but it was just this huge thing. I wanted there not to have been a Holocaust, and I want people not to suffer. I want there not to be genocides in other parts of the world. I want there not to be tortures and torturing and all kinds of things. I don't want there to be suffering in this world. And that my motives are generally pure because, in that respect, because I'm living a pretty easy, wonderful life in my retirement. So I have good motives, but it doesn't matter. I want to be in charge of life, and life isn't going my way. And the frustration is killing me. Or it can kill me if I don't do the steps. On the other hand, I've wanted people's good opinions of me, and I've wanted people to love me who didn't love me, and I've wanted things from other people that they didn't want to give me. And that's, my motives were a little bit more selfish in the normal meaning of the word. And the Big Book describes us as basically being people who are actors in a musical, who want to be the director, the screen, you know, the music, the composer, the lyricist, and all that. We just want to be in charge of life. Now, for many of alcoholics, the ones that they describe, this means that you're always battling life. For many of us, it means we isolate. We just give up, but our mind doesn't give up. We're full of frustration. We're full of being upset. For many alcoholics described in this book, the reaction to life not going their way is anger. For many of us, it's sadness and self-pity rather than anger. But constant thinking about what if and what could have been and if onlys. And for us, it may not be anger. We may not feel we're capable of anger. Anger is not an emotion that's appropriate to us because we have such low self-esteem. We have such bad feelings about ourselves that anger, you don't have the right to be angry. But we have these frustrations and resentments in our lives. I'll be discussing that when we get to step four. But our problem is we want to be in charge of life. It's not going our way, and we're killing ourselves as a result. So our relying on our self-will is killing us. What do we have to do? We have to find a way to live according our life according to what we most deeply believe in, whether it's our specific kind of deity or God, or whether it's our deepest values. We have to find a way to turn our life over to what we most deeply believe in rather than what we want out of life. That's the will and the life. What do? We say the step three prayer, which signifies our decision to go on with the rest of the steps. And that's pages 60 to 63. And we'll find, when the Big Book talks about step four, step three is worth nothing unless it's at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things which are blocking us off from our deepest values, to get rid of the blockage. The image is kept all the way through this book. And we'll find that that's what steps 4 through 9 do, not step four. Because it says in step four, made a searching, fearless moral inventory. But we'll see that the Big Book's description of an inventory is steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. I'll show that to you. So we're back. We'll be back at 1:30. Thanks.
Thank you.